The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. In the United States and Britain in prophecy, Herbert W. Armstrong identified the early American emigrants as mostly being from the biblical tribe of Manasseh in passing the birthright promises to the two sons of Joseph in Genesis 48 there. Jacob said Ephraim's descendants, that would be Britain today, he said Ephraim's descendants would become a company of nations in these latter days, and that Manasseh would become a single great nation. Joseph is a fruitful bow, it says, even a fruitful bow by the wall, whose branches run over the wall. That's in Genesis 49. It says in the United States and Britain in prophecy that these descendants of Joseph, of course, would be a colonizing people in the latter days, branching out from the British Isles all over the earth. But then Mr. Armstrong in this book, he said, how can we be Manasseh when a large part of our people have come from many nations besides England? He said a large part of Manasseh remained with Ephraim until the separation of New England, but our forefathers were to be sifted through many nations as corn through a sieve, yet not a grain to fall to the earth or be lost. That's quoting from Amos 9 and verse 9. Mr. Armstrong said, our people did filter through many nations. Ephraim and much of Manasseh finally emigrated to England together, but many others of Manasseh who had filtered into and through other nations did not leave them until they came as emigrants to the United States after the New England colony had become the separate nation. This does not mean that all foreigners who have emigrated into this country are of the stock of Manasseh, but undoubtedly many are. Many are. He says Israel, however, always did absorb Gentiles who became Israelites through living in Israel's land and intermarrying. Thus, he says finally, we have become known as the melting pot of the world. Instead of refuting our Manasseh ancestry, this fact actually confirms it. The fact that Americans did come into the melting pot, as it was commonly called, it actually proves our identity. And if you look at why so many were able to assimilate into this melting pot, well, you have to go back to the truth covered there in the United States and Britain in prophecy, that it was because so many of them actually were of the tribe of Manasseh. Not all of them, as he said there, but many were. If you look at immigration statistics in the United States, prior to 1970, 80% of America's immigrants came from Europe, many of them coming from Britain, from Northwest Europe. And as I say, they assimilated together for the most part. But now if you go and continue studying Mr. Armstrong's book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, you can see, of course, if you know anything about that work, it talks about the blessings that God bestowed upon our people thanks to Abraham's obedience, and how that after he fulfilled those promises made to Abraham, then the prophecies of God, Deuteronomy 28, Leviticus 26, and elsewhere, talk about those many blessings being taken away because of our sins, which have multiplied. In Deuteronomy 28, it says, the stranger that is within you shall get up above you very high, and you shall come down very low. He shall lend to you, and you shall not lend to him. He shall be the head, and you shall be the tail. And so God prophesied that it would be very different right here in these latter days than it was earlier on in our history. Going back to that figure, 80% before 1970 coming from European areas. Since that time, since 1970, 80% of America's immigrants have come from non-European regions, mostly Asian and Latin American countries. It's very different today. And as you well know, they're not assimilating like those immigrants did generations ago. Pat Buchanan wrote in his book, Day of Reckoning, he said, unlike the Ellis Island generations, all of whom came from Europe, those pouring in today come from countries, continents, and cultures whose people have never before been assimilated by a first world nation. And they're coming in far greater numbers than any nation has ever absorbed. History has never seen an invasion like this, he said. For there are more illegal aliens in the United States today than all the Irish, Jews, and English who ever came. And the total number of immigrants here now almost equals the total number who came in the 350 years from the birth of Jamestown to the inauguration of JFK. It's a different America, in other words. It's an invasion. They're not assimilating. It's no longer a melting pot. A century ago, Theodore Roosevelt said, the one absolutely certain way of bringing this nation to ruin, of preventing all possibility of its continuing to be a nation at all, would be to permit it to become a tangle of squabbling nationalities. It's much worse than that. It's not nationalities squabbling. It's just outright fighting and warfare. Yesterday, there was a report at PJ Media saying the illegal alien crime wave in Texas, it calculated 611,000 crimes, 2,993 murders. That's since 2008. This report says an unreleased internal report by the Texas Department of Public Safety reveals that aliens have been involved in thousands of crimes in Texas alone, including nearly 3,000 homicides. According to the analysis conducted by the Texas Department of Public Safety, foreign aliens committed 611,234 unique crimes in Texas from 2008 to 2014. That's just a 6-7 year period, including, as it says here, thousands of homicides and sexual assaults. The report describes an alien crime wave of staggering proportions, exacerbated by federal officials unwilling to enforce immigration laws. Just like we've heard about quite a lot here lately, these sanctuary cities. But also up at the federal level, federal officials unwilling to enforce immigration laws. There are laws that if they were just enforced, could take care of much of this problem. It says here, from October 2008 to April 2014, Texas identified a total of 177,000 unique criminal alien defendants booked into Texas county jails. These individuals have been identified through the Secure Communities Initiative, in which Texas has participated since October 2008. There are almost certainly more criminal aliens who haven't been identified as aliens. It goes on and talks about how that 177,000... they're the ones that have been fingerprinted, but there's all kinds of others who haven't been put through that process yet. It says arrests of illegal aliens who have not been fingerprinted prior to arrest are not included in these arrest numbers derived from the Secure Communities Initiative. And then finally, that means that the already stratospheric aggregate crime totals would be even higher if crimes by many illegal aliens who are not in the fingerprint database were included. It would be even worse than those staggering figures. 2,993 murders in Texas alone. I saw an NBC report just the other day. It was generated largely because of the attention that Donald Trump is drawing to this particular issue. But this reporter on NBC said that there's no study linking violent crime to immigration. There's no study. There's no proof. And so in his mind, the problem simply does not exist. You have, as the report brought out, federal officials who won't enforce the laws. You have dozens of sanctuary cities who blatantly disregard federal law. And then you have the major media that's quite happy to conceal the true extent of the problem, which is why it's as bad as it is today. Yesterday we talked about that hearing on Tuesday about the sanctuary cities where those family members of victims that have been killed by illegal immigrant criminals, some of them let out of jail, some of them deported multiple times. Well, coming away from that hearing, there were congressmen who were intent on passing legislation that would penalize sanctuary cities for not enforcing the laws. The White House came out. Well, they're dead set against that. They don't want to see any legislation like that at all. This was a report that played on, I believe, on Fox News just yesterday.
The White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest was asked point blank today whether the Obama administration has any problem with sanctuary cities, which are, as you say, jurisdictions that decline to enforce federal immigration statutes on deportation. Earnest spoke of the quote-unquote challenges that the federal government does have in working with local law enforcement on immigration, but he then went on to place the blame on the Republican-controlled Congress for failing to enact comprehensive immigration reform.
So when it comes to law enforcement and making sure that we are cracking down and focusing on those individuals who pose a threat to public safety, it's the president who's done far more than anything Congress has done. There is more that should be done and more that Congress needs to do to put forward a comprehensive proposal to address many of these challenges.
And the White House reaffirmed the president's veto threat of that legislation sponsored by the Republican congressman from California, Duncan Hunter, to compel sanctuary cities to enforce federal immigration statutes. Probably the president will prevail, just given the math on the House and Senate floor.
Any legislation that would compel sanctuary cities to enforce the laws, that's something that the administration doesn't support. This is an administration that believes that legalization is the best way to deal with these criminals, to give them more space, more freedom to roam. We've talked about the mentality with respect to the way the administration is approaching prison reform, reform in schools and so on, remove disciplinary actions, and just work with these problem individuals. And the problems, theoretically, will go away, they think. So you have all these politicians then pointing fingers at one another, saying it's the other guy's fault. And the criminals, meanwhile, are just running wild, like that report at PJ Media said just yesterday. Well, this is something that we'll certainly have to continue to follow, because it's a problem that is only going to get worse. And Mr. Armstrong talks about it in the United States and Britain in Prophecy. He sure does. Deuteronomy 28, as we mentioned, Isaiah 1. It talks about just how different the immigration is going to be for Manasseh, for the United States, in these latter days. And we're seeing it. We're seeing it. Switching now over to Germany. We haven't talked for a couple of days on Germany's conquest of Greece, which was, of course, a big topic, a huge development, prophetically speaking, in the news just last week. This story comes from a website, capex.co/Europe. It says Europe needs Britain in the EU to curb German dominance. It makes some similar points that we've made over and again, but it's worth repeating here. It says, for more than 60 years, German governments have sought a more European Germany. But now Angela Merkel's administration wants a Germanic Europe. That has become increasingly clear since the bailout of Greece's private creditors in 2010 sparked the crisis. in the Eurozone and thrust Germany as creditor-in-chief into the driver's seat. It says, in Berlin's crushing of Greece, combined with the threat to force the country out of the euro, highlights how far a newly hegemonic Germany is willing to trample on others and undermine the system as a whole to achieve its narrow ends. While this is primarily a problem for the Eurozone, it's also an issue for the European Union, not least Britain. Of course, the point made in this article is that the European Union needs Britain just to keep things in proper balance, just as a counterweight to Germany. It says, ever since Germany's reunification in 1990, Europeans have worried that it would come to dominate the continent. Assuaging those fears was one reason why then-German Chancellor Helmut Kohl and France's President François Mitterrand agreed to merge their national currencies into the euro. Monetary union was also seen as a step toward a political one. European leaders thought that sharing a currency would bring their countries closer and ultimately result in some form of federal union. He says, finally, fast forward 25 years, those federalist dreams are in tatters while Germany dominates the eurozone and, to a lesser extent, the EU like never before. Germany dominates the continent like never before. And so Britain needs to stay. But as we know, Britain's not going to remain in the EU. Soon it's going to be on the outside looking in. And then Germany will have full control. Of course, even on the continent itself, we expect the Union to downsize. There has to be those 10 kings, those 10 groups, as the Bible has prophesied. You can read about that in Revelation 17, Daniel 2. We talked about that recently. Switching now to the Iran nuclear deal, this is just one short comment from Prime Minister Netanyahu, the address that he gave before the Knesset on Monday. This would have been July 20th. And that was the day that the UN, you'll recall, accepted the terms of this nuclear deal by unanimous consent. He says, on the day in which the ruler of Iran has reiterated his intention to destroy the state of Israel, the UN Security Council is giving its approval to the same country which has systematically violated the UNSC's decision and which calls for the destruction of Israel, a member of the UN. It says the hypocrisy knows no bounds. The best way to fight this hypocrisy is to tell the truth in a strong and unified manner. Here is the truth. This is Prime Minister Netanyahu. Here's what he said on Monday. They say that this agreement makes war more distant. This is not true. This agreement brings war closer. First, because Iran will receive hundreds of billions of dollars, and it's already openly declaring that it will use this money to finance and arm its terrorist movements and its aggression in the region and around the world. It says, second, there will be a nuclear arms race in the Middle East. So for these two reasons, I mean, here's how we combat this, Netanyahu says. We combat it with the truth. And for these two reasons, war is closer. It's not more distant. Iran has already said they're going to use those multiple billions of dollars to fund their proxy movements, to fund their terrorist organizations. And then even now, because Saudi Arabia and others know what's going on here, it's triggering an arms race all across the Middle East. King Salman of Saudi Arabia, by the way, he's already talked about the misgivings he has about this nuclear deal. He's expressed that to the United States. He's right in line with what Prime Minister Netanyahu is saying. They know that this deal is a tremendous victory for the Islamic Republic. There was a piece in the Wall Street Journal just the other day, too, about the inspections, that 24-day window, and how that, as the journal brought out, even that can be delayed and pushed back to where it's more like 3 months before inspectors could conceivably get into some of those secret sites. Iran inspections in 24 days? Not even close. That was the headline. Not even close. There is another piece in business2community.com. This one says the Iran deal will help Russia's arms industry. Just the ripple effect of this deal. What it's doing in the Middle East. How Saudi Arabia is responding. How these other nations are lining up for business. Lucrative contracts. Russia, you know, right in the midst of it, says the Iran deal will boost Russia's arms industry and make it possible for Russia to replace Iran's older aircraft with newer stealth models. So this helps Russia. They can sell stealth aircraft. And, it, of course, it helps Iran to modernize its air force. It says, thanks to the deal approved by the U.S., the Allies, and by Russia, the arms embargo on Iran will officially be lifted in 5 years. Officially, it has in quotes. So, we've talked a lot about what if Iran cheats? Well, what if Russia cheats? What if Russia decides that, well, there's no way those sanctions are going to be reapplied. There's no way that they'll snap back. Not after all of this has been reversed. Not after all of it's gone through the UN. Everything's passed with unanimous consent. It's never going back, Russia would think. Well, let's just sell them the arms that they want. It says, but the rush to sell arms to Iran has been on for some time, and defense companies from Europe, along with the Russians, Chinese, and North Koreans, have been flocking to Tehran offering their wares. The salesmen are out and about. They're flooding into Tehran, wanting to get a piece of that $150 billion pie. They want to get in on the action. Do you think the mullahs are going to take that $150 billion and, out of the kindness of their heart, pass it along to their people? Well, maybe a small fraction goes to the people. Large chunks of it, as we know, are going to go to building up an arsenal, purchasing weapons, modernizing the Air Force. This article says the biggest single need for Iran is fighter and bomber aircraft. There have been many reports that Iran has already made deals with China and Russia, but the big deals are still ahead of us. That's because until now, Iran did not have the cash. The nuclear deal is pouring cash into Iran, most of which will be spent on arms. Now, that's just the reality. We can pretend that it won't be spent on arms, but that's the reality. That's where it's going, most of it. Which is why these nations are lining up. I want to conclude this segment with this piece by Victor Davis Hanson. It's a history lesson. It says, appeasing Iran ignores the lessons of history. That's what he's trying to pass along to us. What are the lessons of history? Even recent history. Even the history of the last century. He opens his piece talking about how everyone is just cheering, high-fiving each other over the success of this deal. We went through those scriptures in Jeremiah about the ambassadors of peace and how they're going to weep bitterly when they see all of their plans, when they see how all of their negotiations just explode in their faces. Well, right now, there's jubilation in the White House among the diplomats. They're, as he says, high-fiving each other. But this is going to come back to haunt the United States, Hanson points out. He says, first, these are the lessons to take away from this, the historical lessons. First, appeasement always brings short-term jubilation at the expense of long-term security. That's one lesson of history. You can appease. You can buy a little bit of time. You can have short-term jubilation. But at what cost? Looking at it long term. He says, second, the appeasement of autocrats always pulls the rug out from under domestic reformers and idealists. He says, after the Western capitulation at Munich, no dissenter in Germany dared to question the ascendant dictatorship of Adolf Hitler. Nobody's going to challenge the mullahs now. Well, their pockets are loaded with cash. Their position is as strong as ever. That's what this has accomplished. Among other things, it has squashed the dissent. Any dissent, any kind of domestic dissent. In Iran, for sure. It says, expect a Nobel Peace Prize for Secretary of State John Kerry now, followed by Chamberlain-like infamy later. Pretty bold predictions here. But you know what? It's grounded in history. That's the thing. These are lessons from history. Third, another lesson. Third, appeasers always wrongly insist that the only alternative to their foolish concessions is war. Just the opposite is true. That's what the appeasers have been saying. Look, it was either this deal on July 14th or war. And so we chose to not go to war. That's not true, though. He says time was not on Iran's side. Tehran was growing desperate for financial and commercial relief from global sanctions and embargoes. In contrast, the world had no such urgency and could have easily waited for a cash-strapped and ostracized Iran to give up the bomb. All the West had to do was to keep waiting, because the rulers in Iran were suffering. They were in an impossible position. They were ostracized. They were cash-strapped, as it says there. Another lesson. Fourth, beneficiaries grow to hate their appeasers. Such ingratitude might seem counterintuitive, given the gifts that the Iranians have just received from the Obama administration, but we should remember that Hitler called his Munich appeasers worms and pushed them even further. It's not going to make them love the United States more. Well, they already hate us. It's just going to intensify their hatred. They've lost respect for the American power. These are great lessons of history provided here by Professor Hansen. But how many of America's leaders are listening? How many have truly learned or grasped these valuable lessons of history? Not that many. Another lesson. Fifth, he says, allies are always the big losers in appeasement. Britain and France ensured the destruction of third-party Czechoslovakia by conceding to Hitler's demands in 1938 and doomed Poland in 1939. See, the big powers, they appeased Hitler. And then, who suffered right away? Czechoslovakia, Poland, and then, of course, ultimately, it hit the big allies as well, France, Britain, the United States. He says, finally, outside observers of appeasement always make the necessary geostrategic adjustments. Joseph Stalin weighed carefully the democracy's appeasement of Hitler's serial aggressions in the Rhineland, Austria, and Czechoslovakia. By 1939, the Soviet Union had fatally decided that it was as dangerous to have unreliable France and Britain as allies as it was having Germany as an enemy. So, Stalin cut what proved to be a disastrous deal with Hitler that ensured World War II. See, outside observers, those that watch these efforts of appeasement, they're making adjustments. They're making decisions accordingly, according to the terms of these agreements. They see what's happening. He says here, finally, China and Russia will never again see any advantage in joining the West in embargoing and sanctioning a would-be nuclear state. In other words, you can't roll this back. You can't undo this. China and Russia will never again see any advantage to joining with the West on this, on embargoing or sanctioning Iran. Not when such a hard-won common front can become utterly nullified at any moment by a fickle United States. It says both powers, that's speaking of China and Russia, both powers will grow closer to Iran. We haven't learned the lesson of history, and so we're going to have to experience these painful lessons all over again. And the stakes this time, as we've pointed out before, the stakes this time are so much higher than they were in the 1930s. Just because of the weapons that are there at man's disposal today. What a painful lesson our people are going to have to learn. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG here in Edmond, Oklahoma, 101.3 on the FM dial. The live stream is at kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Yesterday I told you about our new book, The True History of God's True Church. From the beginning, God's church has been in a war for its life. That's what our new book is about, that 2,000-year war between God's church and between a great false church. Let's look at Revelation 12. I just want to take you through a few scriptures that I meant to get into yesterday. Revelation 12 talks at length about this clash, this war. The book of Revelation, as you know, it's introduced in a powerful way. Revelation coming from God the Father himself. In chapter 1, you have this powerful description of the living Jesus Christ. And then chapters 2 and 3 talk about what's prophesied for God's church. It gives us the prophecy. And now we can look back and see the history of the seven eras of God's church. And then you move ahead in the book here in Revelation and you read about two churches, two groups that both claim Jesus Christ, and how that these two have warred against each other. Revelation 12 and verse 1, it says, "And there appeared a great wonder in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars." So God here shows John this vision of a woman who is clothed with the sun. The moon is at her feet. She's crowned with stars. This is God's true church. This concept of a woman symbolizing a church, it's found throughout the Bible. And nowhere more prominently than right here in Revelation. This is a great wonder in heaven. God's church is exactly that. It's of God. God clothes this woman. She's a light to this dark world. Jesus said that about his disciples in Matthew 5, verse 14. And so here we are as God's people, proclaiming God's truth, giving off spiritual light to a world in darkness. If you believe the Bible, I mean, you have to know that somewhere on this earth, there has to be this brilliant spiritual light. I read to you yesterday from Matthew 16, where Jesus said the gates of hell would not prevail against it. The church would survive. It's a little flock. It would be persecuted during its 2,000-year history, but it would survive. Verse 2, "And she, being with child, cried, travailing at birth," or in birth, sorry, "in pain to be delivered." So here's God's church delivering a child. It's a struggle. She's working. She's doing. Verse 3 says, "And there appeared another wonder in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon having seven heads, and 10 horns and 7 crowns upon his head." So here's another spectacular symbol. Very different, as you can see there. Very different from the great wonder in verse 1. Here it's a red dragon that's great. This symbolizes the devil himself. This dragon has 7 heads. It's amazing, isn't it? You can go elsewhere in the Bible, in Daniel. Right here in Revelation, chapters 13 and 17. And see a beast very similar to this But in those cases, it's describing the Holy Roman Empire, which tells us who is behind that great system that's come out of Europe. It's now coming out again for the seventh and final time, the seventh resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. Look at history. Leave aside the Bible for a moment. But if you look at history, if you look at the history of Europe, under the rule of this empire, do you see spiritual light? Do you see any spiritual growth? Well, if you dig very deeply into that history, you're going to find a lot of darkness. Now, that empire, the Roman Empire, in a lot of ways, it's like any other empire of this world. It's an engine of selfishness, injustice, destruction, all those things. But the Bible does draw special attention to it. It is unique. It's unique because it's been resurrected seven times, for one. But also, God designates it as something that would be combined together or unified with a great religious system. That's why it's called holy. Again, you can jump forward into Revelation 17 and read more detail about this empire that the devil leads. You look at that beast, and then Revelation 17 and verse 3 talks about a woman straddling that beast. A beastly human government. And on top of it is this woman, again, symbolizing a church. A church that claims to be led by Jesus Christ. A church that claims to be full of light. But what is this church doing? Well, you can see in Revelation 17 that she's intoxicated on the blood of the saints. So step back for a moment. And if you just accept what God is saying in the book of Revelation, what God is revealing here, he's telling you that somewhere on earth is his true church, brilliant, shining light in a dark world. A little flock, persecuted, as I said yesterday. But nevertheless, God's true church. And then at the same time, somewhere on this earth, another church, a great, massive organization, straddling an empire, historically, and persecuting God's saints. Persecuting God's saints. This church, this empire, has warred against God's church. It's spilled much blood over the past 2,000 years. It's tortured a lot of people. And when you look at the prophecy, you think about what's rising right now in the heart of Europe, and then just put it together with what's happened historically. I mean, really, it's virtually self-evident if you just read Revelation and then go and get a world history book. A lot of people ignore this. A lot of people say they're confused by this. A lot of people throw their arms in the air and say, well, I can't understand Revelation, all these symbols and such. But it's not that hard to understand. A lot of people don't want to understand it because they just don't want it to be true. So they close their eyes to the light. They close their eyes to the truth. If you look at some of the older commentaries, Lang's commentary, for example, you know, a very respected commentary in its day, I think written in the late 1800s. But here is this commentary. You can read through its commentary on Revelation and see how it just flat out positively identifies the beast, the woman. That's Lang's commentary. That's not our literature. Well, of course, we talk about it too. Mr. Armstrong did in the booklet, Who and What is the Prophetic Beast? And, of course, a number of other publications as well. But some of the details, Lang's doesn't get it all right, of course. But the fact that it would just positively ID this beast, the woman, pretty amazing. But, well, Lang's Today is out of print. Lang's Today isn't the more modern commentary. It's not as popular as the newer ones. And the newer ones, for the most part, have blotted out this truth. They've erased the truth. This new book that we have, A True History of God's True Church, it brings that truth right to your eyes, to where you can see it. You can scrutinize it. You can study it for yourself. Verse 4, and his tail drew the third part of the stars of heaven and did cast them to the earth, and the dragon stood before the woman, which was ready to be delivered, for to devour her child as soon as it was born. This is talking about Lucifer as he ruled over a third of the angels. And then after his rebellion, he led a third of them in rebellion against God. And those angels are now demons. Lucifer, of course, is now the devil, Satan the devil. Verse 5 says, and she brought forth a man-child who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron. And her child was caught up unto God and to his throne. This verse here gives us a wonderful overview, verse 5. It depicts Jesus Christ being born as a child and his future, ruling all nations with a rod of iron. He was born to be king, as it says in Luke 1. Read what it says in Isaiah 9, verses 6 and 7. You can see why Satan persecutes against God's true church. You can see why God's church is his first target. Because those of us in the church are going to rule with Christ and help him change this world. The whole universe, in fact. This same church that brought forth the man-child. Down in verse 13 it says, and when the dragon saw that he was cast unto the earth, he persecuted the woman which brought forth the man-child. You see that the church is Satan's primary target. The church is being prepared to rule with Christ. Satan hates this reality. He hates this truth. And so he fights against it. He does everything he can to undermine it. Verse 6, backing up, it says, and the woman fled into the wilderness, where she is a place prepared of God, that they should feed her there 260 days. So he's getting into some very specific details here. Very specific details. Again, God IDs the empires. He identifies the empire, the church, the true church, the false church. And here he says in Revelation 12 and verse 6 that his true church would have to run for her life for 1,260 years. That period started in 554. When this great false church really took power of the Roman Empire, starting with Justinian, 554, and it continued through to 1814, when Napoleon was crushed, finally. And the power of this great false church over Europe, over Britain, it was diminished significantly, allowing God's people greater freedom to proclaim God's truth. This is something that the brethren of the fifth era of the church didn't take advantage of like they should have. In any event, that 1,260-year period ended there. Now there's another 1,260 days that this is going to happen. It's going to play out all over again. But going back to this 1,260-year period, I mean, these were dark times. Historians call them the Middle Ages. A lot of Protestants call them the Dark Ages. And for good reason. In many places of Europe, and this is covered in the new history book, the new church history book, there's several places in Europe where you can hardly find a Protestant because they've been They've been killed. They've been wiped out centuries ago. Verse 7 says, and there was war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon fought and his angels. So here is a great spiritual war in heaven occurring in this end time between the devil, his demons, and the archangel Michael and the holy angels. And Michael, it says here, prevailed. And then verse 8, and prevailed not, the devil prevailed not, neither was their place found any more in heaven. So as we've discussed before, Satan and his demons are now confined to this earth. And so what does that mean for this earth? What does that mean for God's people? What does it mean for you? Well, look at this world as we've talked about on this program daily. You can look at this world and understand why it is the way it is by just understanding Revelation 12, verses 7 and 8. Verse 9, and the great dragon was cast out, that old serpent called the devil and Satan, which deceives the whole world. He was cast out into the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. We've talked about this happening around the time of Mr. Armstrong's death, Herbert Armstrong's death, back in 1986. And how that we then entered into a period of no more delay, as it says in Revelation 10 and verse 6. Satan is full of wrath. Satan knows he has but a short time. Satan is off on a lion-roaring rampage. That's why you see the problems in this world worsening. Verse 10, and I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, now has come salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ, for the accuser of our brethren is cast down, which accused them before our God day and night. See, Satan is here, confined to this earth. He's accusing God's church. He's deceiving the masses. And yet God encourages his true saints. Look, you have tremendous power at your disposal. Look at the strength and power, the miraculous power that is behind you. God's church, all through the scriptures, even though little, a little flock, even though scattered at times, God never does picture them as being weak spiritually. They can weaken spiritually if they drift from God, of course. But if they're close to God, they're strong, like the Lion of Judah. And Satan knows this, which is why he accuses them, which is why he spreads lies and deceits about God's people, about God's work, about God's truth. He's an accuser. He can't convince anybody that the true church, that the truth of God is wrong by having them look at the facts. So he just accuses. He maligns. He misrepresents. He lies. He deceives. He does this because he doesn't have the facts on his side. Verse 12 says, therefore rejoice, you heavens, and you that dwell in them. Woe unto the inhabitants of the earth and of the sea, for the devil has come down unto you, having great wrath, because he knows that he has but a short time. He knows his time is short. He knows his time is about up. Verse 13 says, and when the dragon saw that he was cast unto the earth, he persecuted the woman which brought forth the man-child. See, he is grievously troubled by what this woman and her future husband are doing. And so he goes after the church. God calls this a time of great woe. You look back at Mr. Armstrong's death in 1986 and all that has happened since. Well, verse 14, it culminates in this miraculous protection that God's going to provide for his church, for this woman. She's given two wings of a great eagle so she can fly into the wilderness, into her place where she's nourished, it says there. The prophet Daniel, and here in Revelation, John's book, These are the only two biblical writers that wrote about the tribulation in this way, about God having to intervene to protect his people, to protect this woman. And then verse 17, and the dragon was wroth with the woman and went to make war with the remnant of her seed, which keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. And so he can't get at that true church, and he goes back to make war against the remnant of her seed, those that were lukewarm, those that drifted away from God, those that, as it says here, have the commandments and the testimony. Nothing is said about their faith because their faith had gotten weak. They were weak in faith. They became hard-headed and rebellious in so many ways. But upon repentance, they can get it back right with God, and that again will make them a huge target in the devil's eyes. You can see why you need this new book, The True History of God's True Church. We make it available to you freely at thetrumpet.com. You can email us at td@kpcg.fm if you'd like for us to send out a free copy today, so you can have one there for your library at home. But go to the website now, if you like, and begin your study of this fascinating truth, a true history of God's true church. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma. The live stream's available at kpcg.fm. Thank you for listening today, and we'll see you again next week.